expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Some of you are privileged to receive our weekly Media Matters update through email, which tells you about upcoming guests and gives you links to what they've done and past guests and all the information you want. If you'd like to get these weekly updates, all you need to do is email Media Matters producer Victor Picard, and he'll sign you up. You can get off as soon as you want. We don't give these email addresses out. You won't get any junk mail. And all you have to do is email Victor Picard at vpicard@uiuc.edu, and he'll get you signed up and you'll get these weekly blasts. The reason I mention that is if you did receive one of those this week, and there are several hundred of you who do, if not a thousand or so, what you now know is that today you were expecting to hear Janine Garofalo as our guest. The comedian and actress, soon-to-be talk show host, was going to join us to talk about politics, her observations on the media and talk radio. Unfortunately, we spoke with Janine this morning, and she has a very bad sore throat and can't do the show. So we're rescheduling her for some time in April, and we'll keep you posted. And if you get those email blasts, you'll know when we're going to have her back on. In the meantime, though, we're really privileged to have the number one guest in Media Matters history, the person who was with us, I think, on our first show and has been with us more than any other guest in the history of the program over the past 2 years, John Nichols, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine and the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, founded by supporters of Bob La Follette. Oh, some 80-plus years ago at this point. It is such an honor to have John here. Those of you who have listened to the show regularly know that we're very close personal friends. We've written books and articles together. And in my view, there's no one in this country I'd rather talk to about electoral politics than John Nichols, who covers the beat rigorously for The Nation, writes about it constantly, and is now covering, in the midst of covering, the 2004 electoral campaigns. And today we're going to be talking about those issues. Please be ready to call in with your questions and comments. And on that note, John, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, it's great to be with you, although I'm sure that there are folks who were tuning in looking to hear a joke or so, so I'll just say George Bush.
There we go.
I'll do my best.
And for your second joke, George W. Bush?
I know, my second joke would probably be Dick Cheney.
In fact, speaking of Dick Cheney, what our listeners are going to learn a lot more about later is that you're finishing right now a book about Vice President Cheney, and I think you're really almost at the finish line. You're certainly in the red zone.
I hope so.
Yeah. And what's the book about, Vice President Cheney?
Well, the amazing thing is that Dick Cheney has spent his entire career trying to stay out of the limelight. His Secret Service name used to be Backseat because he would always sit in the back seat of the official cars with whoever was in power, but he wasn't the person who was officially seen as being in power. And so, amazingly enough, for this guy, there's never been a biography. Nobody's ever written about him. So what I set out to do about a year or so ago was to start gathering a lot of the information and putting together a book on him. And it's just remarkable. I begin with the basic concept that Dick Cheney is the president of the United States, not George W. Bush.
Now, that was pretty widely accepted the first year Bush was in office, that really he was not really smart enough or really tuned in enough to really care enough about the job, and that Dick Cheney was actually the one calling the shots. But since 9/11, that seems to have changed. I mean, Bush is now seen as being in the driver's seat more.
Well, that was the product of a very elaborate public relations campaign and some very subtle misuse, frankly, of the media. The White House was conscious of the fact after September 11th that it was very clear that Cheney took control of the country. On September 11th itself, he was in the White House. They had dispatched Bush down to Sarasota, Florida to read children's books. I mean, he was so completely out of the loop. And in fact, Cheney did seize immediate control. He sent Bush flying west. Cheney was the one who came up with the idea of grounding all the planes. Cheney was the one who began the process of authorizing U.S. fighter planes to shoot down any remaining planes in the air. Again and again, Cheney was the one who ordered the leadership of Congress to be flown out of Washington to a secret, undisclosed location. The man took charge of the country. There was no question of that. But the Bush administration got very scared because they recognized that it was becoming increasingly clear that George W. Bush wasn't running things. And so they constructed a campaign to make it appear that Bush really was in charge. Central to that campaign was bringing in Bob Woodward from the Washington Post. And Woodward wrote it, was a heroic and excellent journalist back in the 70s, and obviously was central to the Watergate investigations. But in recent years, he sort of specialized in writing kiss-up books to the powerful. And they produced a book called Bush at War, mm-hmm. which seemed to suggest that Bush was really in charge. And it was a comic exercise, but it helped to produce the image of George W. Bush running the country. I would recommend to people another book, though, by James Mann. It's called, it just came out. It's called Rise of the Vulcans, mm-hmm. and it's a book on Bush's war cabinet, and it's a much more, Mann is a scholar who's done a lot of research on foreign policy. It's a much more telling book about who's really in charge.
And I assume Mann finds the name Cheney pretty close to the power center.
Yeah, well, what Mann suggests is something a little different than what I'll be writing about, but what he argues is that as regards foreign policy, and remember, we have both foreign and domestic to be concerned with, but as regards foreign policy, there's a group, an internal group he refers to as the Vulcans, because they actually refer to themselves as such based on the statue of Vulcan in Birmingham, Alabama, the hometown of Condoleezza Rice. But this group is Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, Donald Rumsfeld, and Dick Cheney. And the argument is that, that this grouping has run U.S. foreign policy even before the Bush presidency, that they were in critical places. But since the Bush presidency, have taken complete control of it and essentially just invite George Bush in now and again to stamp something or to sign his name on it.
John Nichols is our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. John Nichols is the Washington correspondent for The Nation, writes widely on politics, on electoral politics, on a whole range of issues, including media. John and I have had the privilege of writing a couple of books together. If you'd like to call in and have a question or comment for John Nichols, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. John Nichols is presently at work finishing a book on Dick Cheney, which will be coming out later this year, published by New Press. That's what we've been talking about in the first few minutes of the program. John, before we leave Dick Cheney, do you think he will be on the ticket again this year? Because there's been rumors that he might get thrown overboard if Bush's poll rating numbers go down much further.
Well, there's no question that Cheney is a huge drag on the ticket. He polls about 20% behind George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
So even as George Bush has been collapsing in his poll numbers in the last 3 months, Cheney is much less popular. And so certainly the speculation is big. Obviously, I'm personally hoping that they don't dump him because I...
Your book's in trouble.
Yeah.
It goes into the history bin then.
Absolutely. I certainly want to be able to say my piece on the guy before they dump him. But obviously I'm betting that they won't, and for a couple of reasons. One, the Bush family is famously loyal. Remember, George Bush, the dad, wouldn't toss off Dan Quayle, mm-hmm. who was a far less useful player within the first Bush administration. And so there's a lot of indications just within the family that they don't want to get rid of Cheney. Remember, Cheney is the president. He is running the country.
Mm-hmm.
To dump him creates a lot of dangers beyond just one election. For instance, the question of, well, then who really does take charge? Is it Rumsfeld? Is it someone else? And, you know, how do you structurally carry on all the things that Cheney's doing? There's one other aspect of it as well. Dick Cheney may not be popular with the American people, but he is very, very popular with two core bases of the Republican Party. The extreme religious right. Cheney's 100%er on all right-wing issues, much more so than George Bush. And so he's very, very popular. He's seen as their key man in the White House, along with Karl Rove. Secondly, obviously, he's very popular with a core of the Texas oil and business crowd that's central to the fundraising of these campaigns. So getting rid of Dick Cheney is a complicated task, which there's no question the Bush White House would prefer not to do.
We're talking to John Nichols. The phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with John Nichols. Hello.
I am blown away. This particular show, is just another example of baseless propaganda that can't be proved at all. And I find that the bias, the obvious bias, on your station is deplorable. I can't believe that we spend our tax dollars to support these narrow opinions that you put on the air, and then you don't challenge at all. You just stand there agreeing and asking for more. You don't even begin to challenge your guests at all.
Well, go ahead. You're welcome to challenge our guests.
Go ahead and challenge.
Challenge away.
Do you have any proof other than your own opinion for any of the things that you're saying?
Absolutely. I'd recommend that you head on down to your public library, also paid for with public taxpayer dollars.
You know, the public
and
library...
you answered the question. Let me answer it.
They don't just...
Hey, we're not on... This isn't Rush Limbaugh's show. You don't get to cut the guest off. You asked the question. Let me answer.
You'll let him finish. You'll have plenty of time, caller. Let him answer your first question, then you can go on.
Go down to your public library. Check out Paul O'Neill's book. Paul O'Neill, a very passionate Republican, chosen for the administration by Dick Cheney. Just read the book. If at that point you disagree with me on anything that I'm saying, I'm certainly glad to talk to you.
Just
but Paul O'Neill's book details.
This gives you one opinion again and again, only from one side.
You don't like Paul O'Neill?
Caller, do you...
I don't have any opinion of Paul O'Neill. What I have is an opinion of this particular show and its particular bias.
Well, I mean, I have a point of view, of course, and so
but
do you.
But there's no other point of view on this show.
But you have a point
of view.
One
liberal guest after the next.
But aren't you calling right now?
I'm not a liberal guest, and I'm not tax-supported.
Well, I suspect you are tax-supported. Do you own a home?
No.
Oh, you don't? Well, then, there's lots of things that the taxpayers help people on. I mean, let's be realistic. We live in a functional Western society.
And then badger them incessantly without any sort of challenge whatsoever. I have never seen a guest on this show who didn't have an ACLU card.
I don't have an ACLU card.
I have never seen a guest on this show.
Caller.
Was it like
Caller.
So Caller. Bloody left-leaning
Caller.
That it was completely obvious with any sort of critical thinking to figure, is this person trying to spew their particular bias? And the host, who's a glamour boy of the left, doesn't ever do anything to challenge them.
We're
fed one litany of propaganda from this particular show again and again.
I mean, this is your call is wonderful because it's the classic right wing hit on.
I'm not right wing. I voted
you
for
clearly
Nader
are.
In the last election.
What?
I voted for Nader in the last election because I actually want change. What I see is more of the same from this show again.
But you see what you're saying
again.
Though. It doesn't matter who you voted for. What you're doing is you are attacking when an alternative view is heard.
Yeah, but there's nothing but that view. And again,
would you suggest that the whole of the U.S. media today?
No, I'm
left-wing?
Talking about this show. Like, why don't you bill yourself as the liberal media show?
Well, why don't?
That's
why
what
would
you,
you
are. That's all we ever get from you. One lefty after the next.
Why would you be bothered that there would be one show that would allow occasional alternative voices on? Why would
I'm
that bother you?
That it is.
Why
saying,
does that trouble you?
Why does he always have to have this?
Why are you troubled by hearing a few things that are outside of the mainstream patter of the press?
And I listen to this network. And I listen to National Public Radio on the Internet, all the different shows that are not carried here anymore. And what I find is there's some really gold standard shows like Fresh Air, where she'll bring on a tax expert from one side, and then she'll bring on a tax expert from the other side. Even on this very network, I've heard both sides on different shows. This show, this one, which is not, I mean, there's no control over it from the public. Even if people who don't like the show call into the station and say, the reason I've stopped giving money to this station is because of the clear and obvious bias of this one show.
But isn't it true?
Nothing
that this,
changes.
But isn't it true that this show is the most supported on the station, the one that gets
I would suspect
the highest levels of contributions?
No, I was listening when they had the last contribution fund. He couldn't even make one of the goals.
John, let me intervene here. Caller, you're welcome to your opinion. I mean, your facts, at least with regard to the show, aren't exactly accurate. But I mean, in fairness, I mean, this show doesn't present make an effort in 53 minutes every week to present all sides of every issue.
No, you only present one, yours.
And we've never claimed to present more than this perspective. But at the same time, the phone lines are open to the callers of East Central Illinois to call in with their opinions and ask the questions they want. You called in, you asked a question, my guest tried to answer it. If you have an opinion, fine, we've heard it. If you have a specific question, please feel free.
Because you control everything about the show. You control the forum, You control what gets on and what does not get on. You think that we're going to be the balance for you? What about once in a while not getting a guest that's so obviously to the left and so obviously liberal-leaning and so obviously against the administration and try somebody else and then don't badger them to death?
Well, in fairness, you've been on now badgering me for longer than the first segment I talked in.
Lucky me. I'll take my...
Well, so you've had your say and had control of the show.
Excellent.
Yeah.
It's a takeover. I'll talk to you later.
I don't know. You've had your say.
Thank you, caller, for calling in. Well, okay, that was one way to start the day.
Actually, it's great. You look,
yeah,
that's the wonder of public radio.
No, and as I think our listeners know, I don't badger our guests. The idea of this show is to let guests come on and have a chance to lay out their opinions and not be badgered by the host.
And I think one of the interesting things is, and this is, it, in a way, the callers obviously, you know, got gripes that go far deeper than one show. But in a way, I think it is very important to kind of take off from the Cheney discussion in this direction, because what people should be conscious of is that little 10 minutes at the start there where we talked about Dick Cheney,
mm-hmm.
that's one of the most detailed discussions of Dick Cheney that has occurred on broadcast media in this country since the Bush-Cheney administration came to power, and that's a notable reality. In the United States, we have a media that has essentially ceased to cover politics. And that's something that people on the right and the left should be furious about. Most Americans know very, very little about the people that run this country. And it isn't just in the Bush administration. Congress is covered minimally and terribly by most of our media. The result is that people are often shocked when they hear a brief, serious discussion about a player that they know very little about. And it can be jarring, you know, to say, well, you know, Dick Cheney's in charge of the government. That is a jarring thing to say. It's certainly not something that you hear on CNN or Fox very often. But it is something that if you move into the kind of inner circles of Washington and talk to Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, you will hear a common acknowledgement of. It's just that occasionally there are shows like this one that bring a little bit of the reality of what goes on in Washington out of Washington and into the homes of ordinary folks.
We're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number here, if you want to call in and chat with John or have a question or, like our last caller, comment, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Oh, we just lost our caller in line 2. Impatient. Call in again if you were the person who just left us. We certainly would love to talk to you. John, let's talk about the presidential election
sure.
this year. We've got, I guess it's down to Kerry and Kucinich and Sharpton.
I'm not even sure there's much, at least Kerry's campaigning in Illinois.
Yeah, and in fact, I guess AP is reporting that Kerry now has enough delegates to officially win the Democratic nomination. So I don't know if it's really much of a race then.
Well, I don't know that Sharpton's even made much of an effort in Illinois. Obviously, you folks have a primary on Tuesday.
That's right.
Dennis Kucinich is campaigning around the state.
That's right. In fact, he will be in Champaign-Urbana Monday night.
And so there's, and I certainly think it's healthy to have a contest on either side. So people ought to at least listen to Dennis Kucinich and then listen to John Kerry and try and keep making their choices. But no, the reality is that the Democratic primary process has pretty well settled things. Even Dennis Kucinich has acknowledged in some recent interviews that he's staying in the race mainly to raise issues
mm-hmm.
and to get some ideas into play, and that's an awfully healthy thing. Remember, in our politics in this country, we have often had nomination fights that were essentially settled, and yet someone kept in the process to raise issues, to build coalitions, to do things that I think are of value. A good example of that was Jesse Jackson in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
After a point where he had clearly lost to Mike Dukakis, he continued in to, I think, to put some important issues before the Democratic Party. Another example of it is Pat Buchanan. In both his 92 and 96 races, there was no way that he was going to beat George Bush or Bob Dole. And well after the point where Bush and Dole had secured the nomination, Buchanan remained in the competition to raise a rubric of social right issues as well as some trade and economic issues, which I think is very valuable to the process.
All right, we're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters. We've got a full bank of phone lines, and I'm going to get to them in a second, so please be patient. I have my word that we'll get to all of you. The lines are jammed right now. I'm just waiting to get the notification on what town, who's on which line before I start calling people up. My producer is busily working on that as we speak right now. Now John, what's interesting this year is they pushed the primaries up for the Democrats and Republicans both, and it didn't really matter the Republican side at the presidential level. But now we know the Democratic nominee, it's locked up really at the beginning of March. And we've got then 8 full months before the general election. You know, in the olden days, not too long ago, usually was, you know, late May or June when it was finally locked up, several months later. And already we've gone into the heavy political advertising, negative ad campaigns and just ad campaigns in general for these candidates. Is that a great thing?
No, it's terribly unhealthy. Permanent campaigning is not a useful thing for two reasons. Number one, at a certain point, it shuts the government down. People in Washington stop governing because they are focused on the campaign, and if they do actually take votes in the House or Senate, it is with an eye toward the fall election. So that in itself is unhealthy. Secondly, I think that it feeds into negativism, a kind of movement away from a focus on issues toward trying to deconstruct the other candidate. There's so much time, and the race gets focused on by a media that is more interested in personalities than issues. And by the time you get to November, after a very long race, you end up with two candidates who most people don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we're looking at. To give listeners an example of what I'm talking about here, in 1968, when Bobby Kennedy ran for president, at this point on the calendar, he had not yet announced. Kennedy announced on March 17th, I believe, 1968.
Wow, that's incredible.
And imagine that. Now, Bobby Kennedy ran one of the most remembered and remarkable presidential campaigns in American history. And yet, he wasn't even in the race as of mid-March.
Yeah, well, John Nichols, let's go to the phone lines now and hear what our callers have to say. Line 1, Mattoon, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I just want to make a couple comments. I think you're right. It's sad that the media focuses more on personalities and things of that nature than the real issues, and that oftentimes the races come down to, you know, money, basically. Mm-hmm. And also, as to the last caller, or the upset caller, I find that a lot of times that people, basically, when their views are challenged, they don't want to pull their heads out of the sand and actually deal with the issues and the problems that that be, but rather they go on the attack immediately and bring up his just kind of circle the issue, you know, so to speak. But I applaud your show, and I appreciate your comments.
All right, well, thank you very much for calling. John, do you have anything to say?
Well, the quick thing I'd say to that caller is simply that he's exactly right. It is jarring for a lot of folks to hear a serious discussion about politics anymore because our media does not cover politics in this country, and it certainly does not do so aggressively. I'm struck by the fact that in Britain, before the war in Iraq began, almost a year ago right now, Tony Blair appeared regularly on British television for aggressive and intense interviews with journalists who were not friendly to him. They demanded that he answer questions. They pressured him in ways that you just never see in U.S. media. And obviously, it had a huge impact in Britain. The majority of the British people were opposed to the war. And I think that there are real impacts to a media that does not cover politics aggressively and with a point of view. And I think that in the U.S., we have suffered a lot, and it does cause a lot of people to be shocked by a serious discussion. But that's what we've got to change in this country. I mean, it is a very dangerous thing for a country to have vast areas of the dialogue kind of off limits or simply not discussed. And so that's why I like coming on this show, and it's also why I like, frankly, I'll be honest, I like a lot of right-wing talk radio. I enjoy tuning in to a Rush Limbaugh because I may disagree with almost everything he says, but I like hearing him challenge ideas that I have. because it helps me to, you know, kind of understand where other people are coming from. But more than that, I think that Limbaugh, for instance, does as good or better a job than most of your mainstream TV shows of exploring the day's politics.
That's true. We're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with John Nichols. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air, line 4.
Hello?
Yeah, go right ahead, sir.
I was just listening, and the first thing I wanted, I observed your comments about the lengthening of the campaign season, and I'd like to say I think they're absolutely right on. It's a absolutely nothing does happen in Congress because they all have to posture now, and they can't do the right thing. They have to do what works for the votes. Mm-hmm. So that absolutely is an issue we need to do something about. On the other hand, it was interesting in that I kind of find you sound a lot like the first guy did, not a little more cultured in the approach, but it's still similar in that you're both talking at it. You're talking about, oh, my God, Cheney could be running the country.
Oh, I didn't say he could. I said he does run the country.
And I hear that, and my broader question is, okay, I will assume you have proof he is, but what's the problem? Don't just throw it out there that, you know, this is a terrible thing. I'd just like to know, why is it a terrible thing?
Well, that's a good question. No, that's a terrific question, because there are a lot of folks who would tell you that it isn't a terrible thing.
My wife, the only reason she voted for Bush was because Cheney was there, and she wanted to vote for Lieberman and get Lieberman and Cheney to run together.
You know what? After that vice presidential debate in 2000, I heard a lot of people say that. I think your question's an excellent one, because this is the only reason it matters that, in my view, and I think in the view really of a lot of folks, that Dick Cheney is the most powerful vice president in history, and arguably running the country in an awfully lot of key areas. The only reason that that is of consequence is because it's not something that's talked about enough. I mean, it's something we ought to pay more attention to and discuss and be conscious of for two reasons. Number one, there is the presumption that a president is in charge, not the vice president. And if that's not the case, it's something people should be aware of. And number two, we ought to examine Dick Cheney much more thoroughly than we have. I think that this is one of the real problems of our politics in general in the United States, and it's a media problem. We fail to examine the people who really pull a lot of the strings in the country. That's in both parties, and in Congress as well as the executive branch and the judicial branch. Our media tends to be far too, you know, kind of the moment. Did you smoke marijuana? Did you have an affair with an intern? Rather than focusing on, you know, the fundamental questions of who has power, how they got power, and what they're doing with it. That's what interests me the most, and that's why I'm interested in Dick Cheney. But I think you're absolutely right that there's a chunk of folks in this country, including some very good folks, who might say, you know, thank God.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that again. I was listening, I think it was yesterday. I've been heading across the U.S. With a trip here to pick up some stuff on the East Coast and take it back, and I was listening to the Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Oh, man.
Talking about those. And, you know, it's now, you know, you hear people worried about what did they smoke and when they smoked it, but you don't hear them discussing the true issues like they did in pre-Civil War times or really, even into the 1900s.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And I think this isn't even that long ago. If you look at the substance of, say, the campaigns between Dwight Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson, those were very issue-oriented campaigns. Even the 1960 campaign between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon, which obviously was the first televised debate and things of that nature, you take a look at that debate, that was those debates were detailed, issue-oriented discussions that got down to questions of who controlled what islands off China.
Well, a lot of what you hear or what I see, for all good or bad, TV has made the difference in that you have to put everything into a sound bite.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't fit in a sound bite, or it doesn't play on TV in the short amount of time you have, it doesn't work. So you can't have a detailed discussion. It's just it won't keep anybody's interest long enough. Therefore, you got to go for the biggest, loudest, brashest sound bite you can get, and that's what gets you there.
Caller, I want to thank you very much for calling. We've got a full bank of phone lines, and I want to get on to the other ones. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. And our guest today, John Nichols, the Washington correspondent for The Nation, the associate editor of the Capital Times newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, where John Nichols has been writing editorials for about a decade now that you've been there.
That's exactly right.
And John, just to brag about you a little bit, you won the best editorial page writer for a daily newspaper in Wisconsin many years in a row. I mean, they just sort of give you the word permanently now.
They aren't quite that generous, but at the Capital Times, which is a very unique, locally owned progressive newspaper, very distinct in the U.S., we've always had a very aggressive editorial page. And the funny thing is that we hear from both liberals and conservatives that they like it. The liberals because they generally agree with it. The conservatives because they say, you know, if they've got a bad heart or something, it gets it pumping.
Let's see if we can pump it a little bit more here. Line 3 on a cell phone, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I've asked this question once before, I think, on this program, but it wasn't really answered to my satisfaction at that time, and I want to put it to you. I think it may be a little bit tangential to your subject, but even so, it goes to the opinion in Washington rather than to the press, and that is that back in January, there was an article that appeared in the New Yorker I've blanked out on the author's name. He's the Pulitzer Prize winner who broke the My Lai.
Seymour Hersh.
Yeah. And he wrote about the how the people who were running the intelligence in the White House, the military intelligence, rather than the other that's lacking, sadly, who essentially scrapped all intelligence operations within the government and instituted their own intelligence operation, and which basically backed up the position that they wanted, that is, to go into Iraq, among other things. And I've seen no comment in the press anywhere about this article, although many articles of the New Yorker do appear in one way or another that is commented upon. And I was wondering whether anyone in Washington has seen this article and what the reaction has been to it. Are you aware of this?
Sure. In fact, I had lunch with Seymour Hersh about 2 weeks ago and talked with him about a lot of this stuff. And I have to tell you, first off, that Bob was very generous with me when he introduced me. But the fact is that, in my opinion right now, the best journalist working in the United States today is Seymour Hersh. I think the work that he is doing, deconstructing a lot of the spin, lot of the fantasy about the war on terrorism, has been superb and incredibly useful. I don't always agree with him, and I don't even always like what he writes. But I know you have to read everything he writes because it's the only way you can begin to get a perspective on what's going on. And the article you mentioned is one of a number of articles that have appeared in The New Yorker by Hersh in which he has essentially argued two things. Number one, that the Bush administration has developed a political foreign policy as opposed to a intelligence-based foreign policy, i.e., decisions are made based on the desires of members of the administration to act in certain areas and in certain ways, and then they find intelligence that fits into that stratagem or that rubric. That's the number one thing that he suggested. Number two, and perhaps far more important, it is that it is the wrong strategy, that the approach to the genuine terrorist threats, to the United States, and obviously, as we've seen from what happened in Spain last week, to many other countries around the world, the approach to the genuine terrorist threats should be very, very different than what's going on. The war in Iraq was not the appropriate step to be taken at this point in history. That there were real threats, real issues that need to be addressed. Hirsch says mainly in Pakistan, and I tend to agree with him, that what's going on the ground in Pakistan creates far greater threats to the United States ultimately, both with the spread of nuclear weapons and also with the kind of laissez-faire attitude toward clear terrorist groupings and bases, both within Pakistan and in parts of Afghanistan, that we really ought to be much more concerned about. And so you're right to bring Hirsch up. People ought to read Hirsch. You can very easily. Stuff's online, and it's also The New Yorker is in most stores, and it's also in most libraries, and I strongly recommend it.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, sure.
That is, you still haven't answered my question. What about the people in Washington? Have they read it?
Oh, yeah, sure. They read it first thing first. Yeah. There's no question that Hirsch is very closely read in Washington, has been for a long time, back to when he was writing about Milei more than 30 years ago. And the one thing that you should know is that, of course, it's closely read by the White House. They don't like it. But it's also closely read by some key players in Congress. There's no question that Ted Kennedy's increasingly vocal critique of the war and of the intelligence service. You saw him last week grilling Tenet from the CIA during a Senate hearing, is influenced by the concerns that are raised, not just by Hirsch, but by a number of other folks. So, yeah, there are people reading it. Unfortunately, remember, Washington right now is a company town, and the company is the Bush reelection campaign. The Republicans control the White House and both houses of Congress, and so you don't see the sort of investigations or Senate inquiries or challenges that you used to see no matter which party was in charge.
John, I want to get to a couple of callers, and I want to thank that caller for calling. But before we get to that, to follow up on this issue, Judith Miller of the New York Times, you know, wrote a number of pieces in the build-up to the war, and then after the war began, too, strongly arguing that there were, in fact, serious weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What has now been entirely discredited across the board by all sources, and the evidence she used has been discredited, and it's serious questions about how she could possibly have said that based on the evidence she had at her hands at that time, that she should have taken that seriously. Yet she is still writing for the New York Times.
Oh, yeah.
Jason Blair, you know, fudged on a bunch of stories and got run out of town. And it was a national scandal. Why is it a national scandal for Jason Blair but not for Judith Miller?
Well, this is a question that Alex Coburn, the columnist for The Nation and a lot of other settings, has been asking for some time, and huge kudos to him for asking it. It is the appropriate question. The situation with Judith Miller is one that has become a concern far beyond just the usual suspects, folks who you would expect to be critical of the Times' coverage of the run-up to the war. There's been a lot of folks who have said, you know, the New York Times is a very powerful newspaper, a very influential newspaper in the U.S., and there is an expectation that the information that appears in it would be grounded in something akin to reality. On the whole run-up to the war in Iraq, there are serious questions about the quality of the information they had and what Judith Miller was writing. And what's troubling is that the Times has not gone back to examine that as aggressively as they did, say, at Jason Blair. Now, contrast that with 60 Minutes, and I give 60 Minutes huge credit for this. Leslie Stahl, one of the 60 Minutes correspondents, about a week or so ago, went back to some of the people they had interviewed before the war,
mm-hmm.
making huge claims about weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein and all sorts of other things, and aggressively questioned those people anew and said, why did you say this to us? Who was mm-hmm. telling you to say this? What, you know, really tried to get to the bottom of it. And it was essentially, although maybe not framed in exactly that way, but essentially an acknowledgement that 60 Minutes had been snookered, you know, that they had been fed information that was clearly not credible or shouldn't have been taken as credible, and that they put it on air, and that had a role in getting a war started. And so I give 60 Minutes great credit for doing that. I think the Times really ought to take the same step. But it's very, very hard, because when you begin to ask that kind of question, you shut down a lot of your sources of information. And Judith Miller's selling point has always been, of course, that she supposedly has all these great contacts. Now there's some dubiousness about the quality of the contacts.
We're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. John Nichols is the Washington correspondent for The Nation. We've got a few people patiently waiting to speak with you, John. Let's get back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Normal, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hello, let's talk a little bit of politics, okay?
Okay.
The Republican attack machine is putting out ads now trying to make the election about John Kerry. And being an incumbent, the second term should be about the last 3 years and whether we want four more years of it. Do you think the Democratic National Committee realizes this and will be able to keep the focus on the last 3 years of the Bush administration instead of the other way around?
It's a terrific question. You get right to the core of what's going on right now. So far, the Democratic National Committee has not done a very good job of strategizing politically. They are not the parallel or the equivalent of the Republican National Committee as regards practical politics or strategic endeavors. And I think they're not doing a particularly good job of keeping the focus on Bush. It is a reality that in any political campaign, both sides are going to try and turn the focus toward the negatives of the other candidate. And so it's no surprise that the Bush administration and the Republican Party, the Bush campaign, and lots of ancillary groups are taking shots at Kerry. It is a troubling reality right now, though, that so little attention is being paid to sort of that assessment of the last 4 years. But you can't blame, in honesty, you can't blame the media for that one. That is the job of the Kerry campaign, the Democratic National Committee, and the ancillary groupings that are associated with it. And at this point, they seem to have a hard time figuring out exactly what it is about George Bush they're upset with. Are they upset with the war? Are they upset with the economy? Are they upset with the Patriot Act? Are they upset with trade policy? And in the end, elections are usually decided based on a single issue. In 1992, for instance, the issue was the state of the U.S. economy. It was weak at the time. We were in something of a recession, and the American people bought Bill Clinton's argument that George Bush the dad, was out of touch with economic reality and with what was going on to working people, and that was what swung it. It was an effective campaign, an effective argument. At this point, I don't think the Kerry campaign or the Democratic National Committee have developed their arguments to that point. There's 8 months. Who knows what will happen? But I think that it is, for those who would like to see George Bush beaten, it is a concerning moment because, as you say, so much of the debate seems to be about John Kerry's record, not about George Bush's.
Right. Well, I'd like to make one more point, and then I'll hang up. I think that the pollsters have it a little bit wrong. I think that this is going to be a rout. I think by Memorial Day, a few Republicans running for office are going to be pulling away from Bush. By July 4th, it'll be like Mutiny on the Bounty. And by Labor Day, it'll be George who? I've never heard of him. Thank you.
Well,
thank you very much.
I have heard folks suggest that, although I've heard folks suggest the exact opposite as well.
Well, you know, the one thing that George W. Bush will have going for him, as we all know, it gets talked about, but I think the full ramifications of it still haven't settled in. This war chest for television advertising and political work is simply unprecedented in human history.
Yeah, there's $200 million at least, and then probably that much again if needed. The other thing is, and why I appreciate what the caller says, but what I would counsel people to understand is that if you sort of draw an arc through the United States, you start up around the top of Montana and Idaho, and you kind of circle around down through, you know, Wyoming, Colorado, Texas, and then go across Louisiana, all those southern states, and then arc back up to Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
You get most of those states are very strongly pro-Bush at this point. The polling is very much in his favor. And when you combine the size of the ad campaign with the number of states that I think a Bush campaign begins with, I don't think you're going to see anything akin to a 1964 Lyndon Johnson route or a 1984 Ronald Reagan route. I think it will be a closer contest, and you will Yeah, I mean, one candidate could win by a substantial margin, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, 40 states or 45 states going to one candidate.
You're listening to John Nichols today on Media Matters. We've got a few callers I'm going to get to before the show ends at the top of the hour. Before we get to the next caller, though, let me point out that tomorrow morning on Focus 580 here on WILL AM 580 in Urbana, the guest will be Dennis Kucinich, who we've spoken about, the Democratic candidate for president who's campaigning in advance of the Illinois primary on Tuesday. So listen in tomorrow, 11 a.m. here at Focus 580. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Yes, thank you.
Hello.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Instead of my question, I just want to state that I'm convinced that the war in Iraq was not about weapons of mass destruction or really even about Saddam Hussein. It was about privatization. And, you know, not only the oil, but the phone system, the water, everything else they can get their hands on, you know, in this country. And behind the scenes, I think you can see that that's happening right now. But really, privatization is the driving force behind policy decisions, both domestic and foreign, I think, of this administration. And, of course, that serves crony capitalism like nothing else could, I would say. And since I see Cheney as sort of the quintessential crony capitalist, I wonder how your book may illuminate this process.
Thank you very much, Colin.
Well, I hope it illuminates a lot, because I think you're exactly right. One of the things that people need to understand is this is nothing new. We have in this country frequently had administrations which turn themselves over effectively to one sector of the economy. And you saw that probably writ largest back in the late 1890s when the administration of William McKinley was simply a large corporation seeking to return profits for a handful of investors, most of them who lived in Ohio. And they launched wars, they privatized, they took things over, they claimed federal lands for different folks. And you saw that similar levels of corruption with Warren Harding and the Teapot Dome scandal. This is nothing new. What is significant, I think, is that there has been so little examination of it. You know, you hear the talk about Halliburton, and you hear the talk about, you know, some other, you know, Bechtel and other companies really profiting immensely off this Iraq war. But we haven't seen nearly the level of congressional inquiry that you would have in the past. Remember, when Warren Harding was president of the United States and Teapot Dome occurred, a great oil scandal based on oil contracts out in the West, there were congressional hearings, even though Harding was a Republican president and the Congress was controlled by Republicans. There was a separation of the branches of government between executive and legislative, where the legislative would never allow the executive to get away with the level of what I see as plain corruption that occurs today. And you know, yes, it's nice to blame Cheney or it's nice to get mad at him, but I think the really important thing is to recognize the failure of Congress and, frankly, the failure of someone like a Denny Hastert from Illinois as Speaker of the House to begin to assert the legislative branch as a separate branch of government rather than simply an ancillary of the executive.
John Nichols, we've only got about 3 minutes or so left. We've got two callers who've been very patient, and I want to get to both of them. So let's
quick answers.
Yeah, let's go quick answers. That's right. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hello. Well, maybe we'll have to have another guest for this question. My question is about what was referred to earlier about ideology or policy being primary factor in the production of intelligence. And I was wondering if the guest could talk at all about the production of knowledge and the kind of policies that are being put in place regarding higher education and area studies, like studies of the Middle East and sure. Southeast Asia.
No, I think you're exactly right. Remember that national security concerns historically have driven a lot of the funding for all sorts of research and study in international affairs, area studies.
Social sciences in general.
Exactly. And when you have a government that no longer wants real knowledge, that doesn't want serious inquiry that will produce answers it may not like, you run into real troubles, and clearly that's the case. And the fish rots from the head. We have an administration now that frankly does not want to know or does not want to have discussion about things that don't fit with its ideological agenda. That's dangerous from a a national security standpoint, just from the safety of the country, but it is also dangerous in the long term because we do shut down avenues of inquiry that ought to be open.
John Nichols is our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Time for one more caller. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Yeah, two quick comments and a question. Quick comment, please don't change the format because, you know, one or two irate callers call. This is an important show. It needs to be here. There's plenty of stuff like this where you get a right-wing perspective. I think we're getting a lot more of the truth here, so please don't change it.
Don't worry. It's not going. I'm not changing anything.
All right. Number two, why are people, what is the single issue about the Bush administration? It's the lies. It's related to what you were just talking about. When something doesn't fit into their picture, the EPA report that was just completely edited to take out the things they didn't want to hear. We can't be lied to by our friggin' leader. It's just not okay. So that's the central issue. I think people are beginning to realize that. You can point at a great many things, but it's issue after issue where it's lies. And next question is, Colin Powell really refused to read the first draft of his evidentiary statement to the UN? That's all.
All right, thank you.
Well, it's very interesting you bring that up because one of the things that's a very big part of the book, and we don't have enough time to talk about it all, is the tortured relationship between Colin Powell and Dick Cheney. Cheney was actually very much a part of raising Powell up the ladder of power within the first Bush administration and bringing him into this one. But there have been real fights there, and no one has suffered more as a result of this administration's kind of refusal to look at the realities of international affairs and intelligence than Colin Powell. He's a man who was broadly respected at the start of this administration. I think he's going to leave it as someone who an awful lot of people feel was either duped or played a very nefarious role in spreading a lie.
John Nichols, our guest today on Media Matters. John, we've only got about a minute left, if that. Let's returning to the November elections while I've got you here. Because of gerrymandering, very few of the House seats are really in play, so changing the control of the House probably is going to be difficult. What about the Senate? Is there any chance that Republican control of the Senate could be in jeopardy this November?
I think that it could be, but that really is it's such a broad question and involves so many different factors.
I need your eight-second answer.
The eight-second answer is that if the presidential race turns into a serious contest and John Kerry does develop a real lead, develops a national message, then I think some of that can filter into the House and Senate races, and you could see some real change in this country. On the other hand, if it's a very close race, I think you'll see probably Republicans maintain their control.
Our guest today on Media Matters has been my dear friend John Nichols, Washington correspondent of The Nation. John, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right, great. And next week we're going to have Rick Maxwell as our guest on the show, talking about his new biography of Herb Schiller. The week after that, we're going to have Laura Flanders on the air talking about her brand new book, Bush Women. And following that, Susan Douglas. So we've got a row of authors coming up. Please join us in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. It's been a pleasure having you. I want to thank Victor Picard, my producer. See you in 167 hours.
Crowded U.S. Senate races in both parties highlight this year's Illinois primary. And on Tuesday, we'll see which candidates the two parties choose to face each other in November. Catch the results here on election night, as well as intelligent analysis from statewide experts and a complete wrap-up on Champaign County primaries. Our coverage begins Tuesday night at 7 Central on WILL Urbana, and monitor the results on our website, will.uiuc.edu.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, clear and breezy with the high in the upper 40s and west winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low in the mid-20s and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour, becoming northwest around 5 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, partly sunny in the morning, then mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain in the afternoon, the high in the lower 40s with north winds around 5 miles per hour. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.